Please pray in the name of Christ. We pray. Amen. Dr. Ross.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, is this microphone? I'd better use this one.
Okay, all right.
Well, as you heard announced, we will take questions at the microphone. And if you're shy, you can ask for help and we'll read the question for you. I always come armed with a whole bunch of brand new scientific discoveries. That's what's wonderful about being alive in the 21st century. Every day, research papers are published, which allow us to put to the test our beliefs in God. We can put to the test any number of belief systems. So I've got a paper here that talks about a certain kind of amino acid that they've had in difficulty finding and how that plays a role in the origin of life and different theological perspectives in the origin of life. And just a few days ago, astronomers found the first rocky planet outside of our solar system, and that also has significant implications on different belief systems. And I got a whole bunch more here that we can talk about. So if things get a little bit lax here, I'm just going to dive into these things. Hopefully that'll stimulate some discussion. But as soon as someone comes to the microphone, I stop talking. And also, as you heard Ross Hoagland make announcement, it reasons to believe we publish almost every day an article from the frontiers of science that allows us to put to the test a Christian worldview. It's called Today's New Reason to Believe. It's free. You can go to our website at reasons.org and you can get those automatically sent to your computer. And certain discoveries we jump on right away. And what I mean by right away is literally within hours after they're announced. We don't write an article. We go into our studio and do a podcast, either a video podcast or an audio podcast. And again, you can sign up for those free on our website or at iTunes. iTunes, we have a little account there that allows you to get that. And as Ross announced, we are also going to give away a whole bunch of books here sometime later on. So if you fill out those little cards, you'll be included in the giveaway. And if you fill it out completely, you'll get a free magazine called New Reasons to Believe. And if you don't want that, then don't give us all that information. But you will be included in the drawing regardless. Well, no one's at the microphone yet, so what I'll do is tell you about this paper that was published in Astrobiology just a few days ago. It's got a wonderful title, Biochemical... we got someone at the microphone. I guess I'm not going to get to this. Go ahead.
There's a field of science called abiogenesis, which vaguely explains the origins of life through observation. And I'm wondering, what is your perspective on how life was created on Earth and what you think, or how you think it was formed on Earth?
All right, I'll try to keep this brief because we have an entire book on this subject called Origins of Life. It's over there at the table. And it's actually gotten some positive reviews from leading atheist origin of life researchers. So you can check that out. We've been told it's the most thorough book that's been written on the subject of the origins of life, in the sense that we not only talk about the origin of life on planet Earth, but the possibility of life's origins elsewhere in the universe, the subject of astrobiology. And actually, this paper that got published a few days ago is relevant to the question that was just posed, in the sense that there are three issues that origin of life researchers have noted about the origin of life on planet Earth. The first is, there is no measurable window of time for the origin of life. When I was at the University of Toronto, I had the privilege of taking a course from Carl Sagan, and he laid out his model for the origin of life, which is that the world, the Earth, in the beginning was nothing but water on its surface. And this water was a huge, rich soup of prebiotic molecules, and it percolated for a billion years, and out popped a life form much simpler than the life forms we have on Earth today, from which all life has evolved. That's the Carl Sagan model for the origin of life. It's the model you hear when you attend origin of life research conferences. But at Origin of Life Research Conferences, Azrana, our staff alchemist, and myself heard the discoveries that demonstrated that 3.85 billion years ago, there's an event called the Late Heavy Bombardment. It's when Jupiter and Saturn got into a 1-2 resonance, where Jupiter made exactly two orbits above the Sun for every single orbit of Saturn. That destabilized the Kuiper belt of asteroids and comets and caused Earth and all the inner solar system bodies to be pelted by giant asteroids and comets. In fact, when you look at the Moon, all the craters you see in the Moon, over 90% of them were generated by the late heavy bombardment. And our planet Earth took 30 times the damage that our Moon took at that time. And it was such that it turned the surface of the Earth, evaporated all the water, turned it all into steam, and it turned the rocky surface of the Earth into molten lava. And that would have eliminated all the prebiotic molecules that it could have possibly existed at that time. The interesting thing, though, is that we scientists find the biochemical signatures for life. Basically, it's isotope signatures. There are no fossils. But we find the isotope signatures that tell us that life was abundant and diverse in terms of a variety of bacterial species at 3.83 billion years ago. Well, it would take time for the late heavy bombardment to subside, where you would get water returning in a liquid state and rocks forming on the Earth that were not molten lava. And the time for that takes you back to 3.83 billion years. And so this is the reason why scientists conclude the origin of life took place on planet Earth in an immeasurably short period of time, 3.83 minus 3.83 billion years. And also, as we look at these isotope signatures, they tell us that planet Earth never had prebiotics. We see the signatures of postbiotics, living organisms that decayed into carbonaceous molecules, and see life favors carbon 12 over carbon 13, and it favors nitrogen 14 over nitrogen 16, and it favors sulfur 32 over sulfur 34. It favors certain isotopes, and these isotope signatures tell us that all the carbonaceous molecules that have ever existed on planet Earth are 100% postbiotic. None of them are prebiotic. Well, if you have no prebiotics and you have no time, you have no naturalistic model for the origin of life. And it was a Romanian physicist that was able to demonstrate why Earth never had prebiotics. It's called the oxygen ultraviolet paradox. Those origin of life simulation experiments they do that made Stanley Miller a famous individual, he scrupulously made sure no oxygen in the flask, because it's known that oxygen is deadly to prebiotic chemistry. Even the tiniest amount of oxygen immediately brings to a halt prebiotic chemistry. So if you've got oxygen in the early Earth's environment, there can't be prebiotics. On the other hand, if you don't have oxygen in the Earth's environment, there will be no ozone shield to prevent ultraviolet radiation coming in from the Sun. And at 3.83 billion years ago, ultraviolet radiation from the Sun was much more intense than it is today. So if you don't have oxygen, you can't stop that ultraviolet radiation from coming in, and ultraviolet radiation, like oxygen, is catastrophic to prebiotic chemistry. So here's the situation. If you've got oxygen, you can't have prebiotic chemistry. If you don't have oxygen, you can't have prebiotic chemistry. And that's really what launched astrobiology, which is the idea that since life cannot originate on planet Earth under naturalistic conditions, it must have happened in outer space and somehow got transported to the Earth, which is why both a biochemist and astronomer teamed together to write our book, Origins of Life. I wrote the chapters on why astrobiology still ranks, after more than 20 years of research, as the only data-free discipline in science, in the sense that we are finding no evidence for prebiotics, even, let alone life elsewhere in the universe. and this paper here actually deals with it. The problem is that you can form certain amino acids in outer space, but you can't form the basic amino acids anywhere in outer space or on the Earth. And without the basic amino acids, you can't have a naturalistic model for the origin of life. And what was interesting at the Origin of Life Research Conference that we attended at the University of California in San Diego a few years ago, is at the very end of the conference, a scientist got up to the microphone, kind of like the one at the back there, and said, in this four-day conference, we've ruled out planet Earth as an answer for the origin of life. We've ruled out Mars. We've ruled out all the other solar system bodies and moons. We've ruled out an extraterrestrial planetary system. And we've ruled out dust transport. He said the only thing left to explain the origin of life here on planet Earth is that aliens sent spaceships here and planted life here on planet Earth 3.33 billion years ago. And we actually deal with that in our book, pointing out that there is a very narrow window of time in which intelligent life can exist. Is really less than 100,000 years wide, and it happens when the universe is 13.73 billion years old. It's not possible for intelligent life to exist 3.83 billion years ago. Moreover, it's not possible even for a technologically advanced civilization to travel across interstellar space. It's not a matter of money, it's not a matter of technology. The laws of physics will not permit interstellar space transport. However, we commended that individual for saying he is right. The only answer to the origin of life is an intelligent being putting life here on planet Earth. We were just arguing that he wasn't going far enough away. We really need an intelligent being beyond space, time, matter, and energy that's responsible for creating life here on planet Earth. Sorry for that long answer, but that was a deep question that was asked there at the microphone, and we got somebody else. Go ahead.
Genesis describes in the first six days of creation that there was evening and morning. In a world that's 4.9 billion years old, what does evening and morning look like?
Well, that's an interesting question because, I became a Christian through reading a Gideon Bible over the course of 2 years. And it wasn't until 8 years later that I met a Christian is when I came to take up a faculty position at Caltech that I met Christians for the first time and discovered that there were people who actually read Genesis and presumed that these creation days were 24-hour periods. That never occurred to me when I first picked up a Bible. And maybe I had the advantage of not going to church or not knowing Christians, because I just picked up the Bible, went through Genesis 1 and said, clearly, these days are six long periods of time. You say, how did you draw that conclusion? Well, what I noticed was you've got an evening and a morning for the first 6 days. There is no evening and morning for day 7. And what does it say about the 7th day? It's that period of time when God rests from his work of physical creation, miraculous interventions. That's his day of rest. For 6 days he works, on the 7th day he rests. And what does he do during that rest period? He stops his work of physical creation and targets the problem of evil. And not until the problem of evil is conquered and permanently removed do we see God creating again. There is an 8th day, you'll run into it when you read Revelation 21. But during the 7th day, God's working on the problem of evil. Evil is still here, obviously. And as I read throughout the rest of the Bible, nowhere did I see any closure on day 7 until Revelation 21, when evil is conquered and removed. And so it told me the 7th day must be a long period of time. The other thing I noticed is that when you finish Genesis 1 and flip the page to the first few verses of Genesis 2, it actually uses the word today to refer to the entire creation week. So it says clearly it's got to be more than that 7-day period. The thing I picked up on is that in Genesis 1, it tells us that both the human male and the human female were made on day 6. Yet in Genesis 2, there's clearly a considerable passage of time between the creation of Adam and the creation of Eve. So the 6 day is a long period of time, and the 7th day is a long period of time. All 6 days must be long periods of time, given the grammatical structure of Genesis 1. And I thought everybody believed that in picking up their Bible and reading it. It really wasn't until I came here to California that I first discovered that there are actually people who read Genesis 1 and believe these days are 6 consecutive 24-hour periods. In fact, there's so many of them, I wound up writing a book on this subject. It's over there. It's called A Matter of Days. Now, we have another person at the microphone.
If I use my terminology wrong, adapted. But at what point do you believe that the soul enters us as being? If it is at the point of conception, when the sperm enters the egg, the vast majority of those never implant and are lost.
Have a vast number of what?
A vast number of the implanted eggs never implant,
right.
Lost. So at what point do you believe the soul enters that being? Does the soul require a nervous system to be able to function? Do you see my question?
I think I see your question. And but just to be clear, there are two different usages for soul that you see in the Bible. One that you'll find in the Old Testament is actually a term that applies to the higher animals. How on the 5th creation day, God created animals that are not only physical, but also soulish. And what it means by that is they're endowed with mind, will, and emotions so that they can relate to human beings and serve and please human beings, each in their own distinct way. But in the New Testament, the word soul is almost always, except for one verse, used to refer to the human spirit. And so...
That's why I said spirit.
Right. Okay. So I think you're referring to the spirit. At what point do human beings become spiritual? And this question is addressed in Psalm 139 and Psalm 51, both written by King David. In Psalm 51, King David makes the point that he was a sinner from the time he was conceived in his mother's womb. And the declaration that he was a sinner is something that can only apply to spiritual beings. This is a point that the Apostle Paul makes very clear in the Romans chapter 5 and 6, how this is something that only spiritual beings are capable of experiencing. And then in Psalm 139, King David talks about how God was present when his body was first formed in his mother's womb. So the Orthodox Christian interpretation of this is that the husband and the wife are responsible for the physical and some of the soulish characteristics like what we see in the birds and mammals when they have intercourse and conceive. But at the point of conception, this is when God intervenes and makes that conceived human being a spiritual being. And so because there's some people who take the position that we have existed in spiritual form before we were conceived. But the Orthodox position, based on what you see King David writing and the Apostle Paul writing in the book of Romans, is that we humans do not exist until we're conceived in our mother's womb. But at the point of conception, we're not only physical, we're not only soulish like the birds and mammals, we are spiritual. And you say, what happens to humans that are still in the mother's womb and are aborted or discarded as a result of failure to move from that first few cells on up into a recognizable multicellular, multi-organ individual? We don't know, except for what it tells us in John chapters 1 and 3, which makes the point that God's light goes out to every human being. And that God's light shines into the spirit of every human being. If you receive that light, you'll get more light. It says if you receive that light, you'll proceed to salvation. If you reject that light and run away from the light, then you proceed towards condemnation. And it makes the promise that every human being has received that light. So on that basis, I do not believe in an age of accountability. The idea that you've got to be 12 years old before you're educated and intelligent enough to understand what God is offering to us through Jesus Christ. No, God's got other ways of communicating to us. And he's got ways of communicating even to a fetus inside the womb of a woman. And so they too get to choose where they want to spend eternity. Somehow God's spirit communicates with that spirit. Another way of looking at it is the body that we have, the brain, the physical brain that God gave us, is basically a piece of hardware that's an interface for our spirit. Our spirit is able to communicate because of that interface. And when the interface gets broken, or is not able to form in the first place in any degree, like what happens inside the womb, that doesn't mean that the spirit ceases to exist or ceases to have the capacity to communicate with God's spirit. So that's a limited answer. That's probably as far as we can take it at this point.
But do you believe it's that sperm and embryo, or do you believe that it's like the first cell division?
Well, there is some debate within the Christian community. Does the point of conception refer to when the cell is fertilized, or does it refer to when it reaches the 8-cell point, or maybe a few minutes thereafter? But, you know, you could argue that those are really fine points of debate. We're only talking literally within the first hour after conception that all that happens. So somewhere in there, the spirit gets attached. And I don't think it's necessary to put too fine of a point on it. Maybe sometime down the road we will. I don't know.
In addition to the lack of time you pointed out from the end of the heavy bombardment period to the start of life, basically zero time unless you're benefit. And therefore, there's no time for life to evolve on a natural space. And yet, the Cambrian period, which of course, as you will know, is that 50-85% of all phyla on this planet occurred on a geological time scale in a millisecond. Now my question leads to the dinosaur era, where you have the Triassic to the Jurassic borderline, and also the Cretaceous, the end of the Cretaceous into the mammal period. In each of those two areas, we have mass extinctions. And my question is, I have heard, and I'd like to have you clarify if I'm right, that in each of those instances, within about 10,000 years, and I've heard maybe 100,000, but that's part of my question, within 10,000 years of those mass extinctions, we have thousands and perhaps millions of new species appear in the fossil record right after those mass extinction events, which again show the impossibility of naturalistic evolution, because new forms just cannot appear that quickly.
Okay, interesting comment. And when you look through the fossil record, you see a number of mass extinction events. And a mass extinction event is defined where at least 25% of all species on Earth go suddenly extinct. And, you know, there are actually extinction events that go up as high as 90 to 95% of all species going extinct. Then following each of these mass extinction events is a mass speciation event. And one thing paleontologists love to do is to do core drills where they can measure what's happening on the either side of that extinction event or speciation event and see what's going on and measure the rate. And what you're referring to are the two places in the fossil record where we can get the most accurate information. Typically, when you do a core drill, you're getting fossil remains and dates for the strata in which it's embedded with error bars of like plus or minus 10 million years or plus or minus a million years. But in the two examples you mentioned, they've got much more accurate measurements. And this is the boundary between the first generation of dinosaurs, the Triassic, and the second generation, the Jurassic. So there's that boundary. And then this other boundary referred to is the last of the dinosaurs, the Cretaceous dinosaurs, going extinct and then being replaced by the tertiary radiation of birds and mammals. And both of those, we've got really good data, which shows us that the time between the mass extinction event and the mass speciation event measures to be about 10,000 years, a maximum of 100,000 years, and it could be less than 1,000 years. And so here, and not only that, in both cases, we have data that tells us what was responsible for the extinction. In the case of the Jurassic-Jurassic boundary, it was five giant comets striking the North American continent. And in the case of the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, it's a single giant asteroid striking the Yucatan Peninsula. I don't know, it seems like North America is the most disaster-prone continent on the planet. In both cases, it caused all the dinosaurs to be wiped out and to be replaced by a brand new set of creatures, all very large and very complex. And that's a serious challenge to a naturalistic evolutionary explanation. How can you wipe out all the big animals and just 10,000 or at maximum 100,000 years later get a complete replacement of thousands of species that are likewise very large in body size and very complex? And, you know, we've written about this in a book over there called More Than a Theory, where we point out that these mass extinction events and mass speciation events, from the perspective of a supernatural creator, is vital to maintain long-term history of life on planet Earth. And it's because the sun is getting progressively brighter and brighter as it continues to fuse hydrogen into helium. And so life that's appropriate at one particular epoch in the Earth's history will not be appropriate in the future history. And it's crucial for that creator to intervene at just the right time, in just the right way, and remove species of life that are a problem now for the increased luminosity of the sun, and replace it with species of life that will be more appropriate. Because it's life that regulates the atmosphere and the crustal chemistry of the Earth. And so as the sun is getting progressively brighter and brighter, the creator steps in to remove certain species and replace them with different species that will be more efficient at removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. And we see that this has been going on throughout the entire 3.8 billion year history of the Earth. It's actually slightly more complex because of 3.8 billion years ago, the sun is actually getting dimmer. Then it turns around and gets brighter. What we see is we have a creator intervening at just the right time and just the right way to remove precisely those species that need to be removed and replaced with those that are much better adapted for making sure we got the right chemistry in the atmosphere and the right chemistry in the crust of the Earth. You can read about it in More Than a Theory.
I wanted to say something about how we're talking about when there's a drastic change in the environment, such as sudden mass extinction, how species can just explode and so many new species can appear suddenly out of nowhere. I believe it's because when species are wiped out, there's a drastic change in the environment, and that gives a chance for new species to grow and to form. If the dinosaurs are wiped out, the rats and the small mammals are going to evolve into more efficient biological organisms that can grow and evolve. Suddenly, the predators of the mammals are not there, so you can have a drastic change in the environment and in the species because there is a tremendous change in the environment that goes along with it. So, but my question was, if every single life form on Earth contains DNA, plants, invertebrates, all animals contain DNA, wouldn't that explain that there is a common ancestor in every form of life? Because if every form of life on Earth has the same mechanics behind it, that would kind of explain that life must have started only at one time on Earth. And maybe you believe that a creator created all sorts of species all at once, but in every single form of life on Earth can contain DNA, that disproves that theory.
Okay, you're making two points here, so hopefully they'll remember both as I go through this. And what you're bringing up first is the standard response that evolutionists make to the problem of mass extinctions and mass speciation events. They will say, well, it's just a natural event that wiped out all these species, and it creates habitat room. What they mean by that, when you've wiped out millions of species of life, then that means you've got room for the species that survived to fill in the niches. And you made a comment, too, about how if you take out the predators, that allows the herbivores to multiply and fill out the niches. Well, there's two points here. Number one, you've got to have the predators. If you take away the predators, things get much worse for the herbivores. They get disease, and you wind up having a population collapse. And we've written a number of articles on this, you'll see them on our reasons.org website, and that's also in the book, More Than a Theory, that predators are crucial for maintaining the health, the adaptability, and the population levels of the herbivores. They also play crucial roles in recycling the nutrients. And we've learned that, for example, our wiping out 95% of the whales in the last century was a huge mistake. And by bringing the whales back, they're not back to the population levels they were, but they're starting to come back, as we're seeing a recovery in all the species of life that the whales were feeding on. It's a very interesting story. When whales feed on their prey, it actually stimulates the entire food chain and allows, for example, to be more squid for the sperm whales to feed upon. When they got rid of the sperm whales, almost wiped them out, the squid population catastrophically dropped. When they brought the sperm whales back, the squid population rebounded. And so what we see in these mass speciation events, which is very interesting, is that you have millions of species removed from the planet, and then very quickly millions of species replace them. But the millions of species that replace them have come in optimized ecological relationships, where you've got just the right predators, just the right herbivores, just the right detrivores, and just the right parasites. You might think parasites are bad, but parasites are actually crucial to maintain the health of both the carnivores and the herbivores. But this is the thing that's amazing. Look at the fossil record. The mass speciation event is not something that evolves over a period of time into an optimized ecological system. It's optimized right away. And, the idea that you wipe out the dinosaurs, that's what made room for the birds and the mammals. Well, there were birds and mammals existing in the Jurassic era, as well as the Cretaceous era. It is true, after the dinosaurs were wiped out once and for all, with the Cretaceous mass extinction event, then we have this radiation of thousands of new species of birds and mammals. But for example, when the Triassic dinosaurs were wiped out, birds and mammals didn't replace them. It was new dinosaurs, a completely different set of dinosaurs. And it happened twice. After the Jurassic dinosaurs were wiped out, the Cretaceous dinosaurs replaced them. So it doesn't necessarily follow that you're going to get completely different species of life when you have a mass extinction event. Which is why I argue, if you look at the physics of the sun and the physics of the solar system, you get a much better model or a much better explanation for the history of life on planet Earth. In the sense that with the wiping out of the Triassic dinosaurs, there was a need for a new set of dinosaurs that would do a partial compensation for what was going to be happening in the future physics of the sun. If you introduce certain plant species and birds and mammals too quickly, you overcompensate for the increasing luminosity of the sun. So that's the reason why God said, nope, we're going to keep the dinosaur thing going, but if we're going to use different dinosaurs, that will compensate, because the sun's luminosity goes up very slowly. It has increased by 15%, by 15% only over the last 3 billion years. So you don't want to overcompensate. You want it to be just right. And this is what argues for a supernatural, superintelligent creator. Is it a mass extinction event? Go ahead.
Well, the circumstances of what you're saying are much more complex than just the sun's luminosity is increasing over time. I mean, this happened billions of 65 million years ago or so. So I'm sure that, you know, just to say that God put the dinosaurs in that place and that's the explanation, I think it's a lot more complex than that, because it's a lot more difficult than we might make it to explain something accurately that happened so long ago.
Well, I would agree with you, it is more complex. And what you'll see in my book is that, for example, the radioactivity in the interior of the Earth has declined by 5 times since the origin of light. And so there's a need to compensate for the different heat flow coming out of the Earth. And also we have the continents becoming more and more expansive over the surface of the Earth. So it's not just the increasing luminosity of the sun. The tidal effect of the moon is changing because the moon is spiraling away. So there's many factors that have to be compensated for. But this is the amazing thing that happens when you integrate physics and astronomy with biology and paleontology, is that suddenly you can see that from a creator's perspective that knows the future physics of the interior of the Earth and of the chemistry of the Earth and of the moon and of the sun, is able to make sure we got just the right light and just the right quantities and types on the Earth at just the right times all the way through. And you might say, well, maybe it's just a sheer accident that things were just right at the Cretaceous tertiary boundary, but the truth is there's over a dozen mass extinction and mass speciation events we can document just in the last billion years. And you're right, when we go back greater than a billion years, then our data becomes a lot fuzzier, and we really don't know what's going on to the accuracy. But where we do have good data, it shows us that we're getting intervention events by something or someone who knows what the future physics and chemistry of the solar system and the Earth and the sun really are. So that's one of the arguments, that it can't be just a naturalistic causation. You need a mind that knows what's going on to make sure you do just the right thing at just the right time. Okay, go ahead.
You've kind of answered one of my questions, which is the Goldilocks theory that you espouse, because we can all imagine God and his control panel, cosmic control panel up there, taking all these things, so everything would be just right for his loving human creation, the Lord of creation, us. But we're only enjoying a brief interlude, because, like you say, the sun will wipe us out eventually. So we wanted to enjoy a brief interlude in a great, greater cosmic drama. So we are nothing compared to that.
Well, that doesn't necessarily follow, but you are right. There is a very narrow window of time.
The other thing is that we'll skip this old thing, because that's immaterial, and science cannot prove or disprove that. So we'll go to material. One of the things that you said was, well, getting back to the origin of life, is that God loves extinction. We've had, 5 or 6 already.
At least a dozen.
And he loves to create it. And, I mean, it took him 13 billion years to finally create us. So he's not too fast. But the other thing I wanted to ask you, when you say that the origin of life began at 3.8 million years ago, that kind of negates. You can throw out the Genesis. I mean, there's a lot of quarreling
which because the Old Testament and the Old Hebrews couldn't tell what a, how long a day was or a night. So you could pull that out if you say, well, origin of life was 3.8 billion years ago.
Okay, it's 3.8 billion, roughly, years ago that we had the origin of life. And what you'll notice in our book on the origins of life is we contrast the non-theistic model with the Christian theistic model. And it's interesting you mentioned Genesis 1, because Genesis 1 implies that the origin of life occurs at the beginning of creation, day 1. The Spirit of God is brooding over the surface of the waters at the beginning of creation, day 1. You know, let there be light. That means we now have light from the sun coming through to the surface of the waters that would permit photosynthetic life to exist. And we actually have chemical signatures that tell us that photosynthetic life was abundant at 3.83 billion years ago. And so from a Christian perspective, the origin of life would take place early in the history of the earth, not late. It would be immediate, not over a long period of time. And it would be under hostile conditions because it says the world was formless and void, tohu wabohu, which is a phrase you see throughout the Bible referring to hostile conditions. And indeed, we got measurements to tell us that when life originated on planet Earth, it was indeed a hostile environment. And it was the origin of life that transformed the hostility into an environment that was benign for progressively more and more advanced life. So in that sense, we would argue that Genesis 1 is consistent with the discoveries that we've been making on life's origins and life history. And what you see in Job 38 and 39 and Psalm 104 is that God created life in such a way that that life would serve the needs of humanity and allow humanity to launch and sustain global civilization. And that requires a huge amount of biodeposits. They say, why did God wait 3.8 billion years before he created us? He wanted to make sure that we had enough iron ore in the crust of the earth, that we had enough coal, oil, natural gas, enough copper that we could get, and that actually the environment would be safe for advanced life. The early earth was not safe for advanced life. It was loaded with soluble metals, which would have been deadly for advanced life. It was 3 billion years of bacterial activity feeding on these metals that transformed from a soluble form into an insoluble form that made the planet safe for advanced life. So it explains why you don't get advanced life until the Cambrian explosion. The bacteria have to make it safe for that life, first of all, but we are the beneficiaries. A byproduct of all that bacterial activity is we have a planet with concentrated insoluble ores that we can mine to launch civilization. So when you celebrate Thanksgiving and you pick up your knife and fork, you might want to thank God for all those bacteria that made it possible to mine the ores so we could have knives and forks in the first place. That's not a given. It takes a very careful and long history of life to make all that possible. And you're also right that we human beings are an extremely narrow time window. It's something I've written about in Why the Universe is the Way It Is, that there's a broad window of time in the physics of the universe that permits bacterial life, about 4 billion years wide. But the window of time for intelligent life, like ourselves or the equivalent, is less than 100,000 years wide, which is actually good news. It means that God's going to conquer the problem of evil quickly, not slowly, because we argue that the window of time is going to close within about 20,000 years or less. So it means that somehow God's got to work out this problem of evil in that period of time. So you say, why did God take billions of years to create? He took billions of years to create, so we would only have to be exposed to evil for thousands of years. It could have it the other way, but I would argue this is really the preferable solution. Go ahead.
We've been seeing in the media that they may have discovered the Garden of Eden as a model of the Persian Gulf, and that originally it was on dry land.
Yes.
And that humanity expanded from there. The alternative explanation of the meaning, alternative explanation by the sense, is that life turns out to be African. Can you comment on these two?
Well, that's an interesting question, and you'll see some articles we've written about this at reasons.org, is that they've been discovering these archaeological remains of small towns rimming the Persian Gulf, and speculating that maybe there was a civilization in what is now underwater. And at the close of the last ice age, most of what is now the Persian Gulf and possibly all of the Persian Gulf would have been dry land. Research shows us that there was at least a land area bigger than Great Britain that was dry 40 to 50,000 years ago. And what's interesting about that is if you calibrate the Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies, it puts the date for Noah at roughly 40,000 years ago, give or take 10 or 15,000 years. And so at the time of the Genesis flood, the Persian Gulf was largely dry. By the way, good chunks of the Red Sea were also dry. And that solves a couple of problems. Because, you know, we do find the greatest diversity in human DNA in the Horn of Africa, you know, what is now Ethiopia, Somalia, Kenya, those regions. But what it tells us in Genesis 2 is that the Garden of Eden was the confluence of four great rivers, the Tigris, the Euphrates, the Gihon, and the Pishon. And thanks to satellite imagery, we now know where the Gihon and the Pishon are. Because you can look in southern Arabia and see that there is an ancient riverbed of big rivers that flow through southern Arabia. One coming out of the mountains of central Arabia and one coming from the south western part of Arabia. And so that would be the Gihon that flowed out of what is called Kush. Kush is a name attached to that area around the Port of Aden. And notice it's very close to Africa. And so it would be easy for humans to migrate up the Gihon River and cross into what is now Africa, because it's dry land all the way. The Tigris and Euphrates flow through Mesopotamia. The Gihon and the Pishon flow through southern Arabia. On today's map, there's nowhere where the four rivers come together. But if you look at the map of the world 40, 50,000 years ago, those four rivers actually do come together in what is now the southeastern part of the Persian Gulf. And so in our model on Genesis 2, 3, 6, 7, and 8, we place the Garden of Eden in what is now the Persian Gulf. And yeah, just recently, archaeologists have been discovering evidence that there was the first human civilization. The first towns that we see are around the edge of the Persian Gulf. And there's actually exploration with divers going on, which is why we're hoping there will be peaceful conditions around the Persian Gulf area, so this research can continue to actually see if there are civilization remains in what is now under the Persian Gulf, and maybe even discover the Garden of Eden. So that's the one place where the four rivers come together. And with the human population growing out of Eden, they'd be naturally walking up the four rivers into Mesopotamia and also into southern Arabia and into Africa. So that explains why you see all that genetic diversity. Incidentally, when you look at the DNA evidence, what it tells us is that the human species remained in one location for a significant period of time, and then roughly 40 to 50,000 years ago, there was an extremely rapid migration into all parts of the world, and then the migration stopped. So it wasn't a random migration like you see with birds and mammals. This was just a very brief period of extremely rapid migration, and then no migration. And so that would explain why we see the genetic signatures of the different peoples that we do all over the world. And by the way, it's consistent with what you see in Genesis 10, where it talks about God literally forcing humanity to spread. Because what is the command he gave to Adam and Eve? Multiply and fill the earth. They disobeyed both commands. And after the flood, humanity once again was remaining in one place, one nation. And God stepped in and scattered the peoples over the face of the earth. And now we've got DNA evidence showing that event. And also we have geophysical evidence that shows us there were land bridges connecting all the continents of the world at that time. And as the sea levels rose at the end of the last ice age, those land bridges broke, preventing the peoples that were scattered into Australia, North America, and South America, for example, of returning and repeating the errors that we see in Genesis chapter 11. What was God doing? It was basically antitrust legislation. He knew one nation in control of all the peoples of the world is a prescription for that leaders of that nation to oppress its citizenry. So there are multiple nations having to compete with one another economically and for citizens. That's a check against the leaders of all those different nations oppressing their citizens. And we happen to live in a nation that's a beneficiary of other nations oppressing their citizenry. And so they left and came here. All of us in this room, I don't see any Native Americans here, would be products of the fact that our nation chose not to oppress its citizenry to the degree that other nations have. Maybe there'll be an exodus out of California, I don't know. Anyway, next question.
My question is,
One at a time, please. I missed a question from one of the people there.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay.
On the last day of creation, it says that God rested, which implies that he's no longer creating.
Right.
And that death didn't come until after the fall, which implies that all creatures were vegetarian before the fall. So how do you come to account that you have carnivores and all this evolutionary type of things happening because of the change in the elementary tract and the transition of the creatures from going from a vegetarian to a carnivorous lifestyle?
Okay. What it tells you in Genesis 1 is that Adam and Eve were told by God that they were responsible and managed the planet for the benefit of all life. And it ends by saying, be sure to take care of the green plants. Because if you don't care for the green plants, nobody gets to eat. That's the base of the food chain. And the fact that it said green plants and not plants generically, I think removes the need to interpret this as a command that all life was vegetarian. No, it's simply saying this is the base of the food chain. And there's a reason why Adam and Eve and their descendants were told to stick to a vegetarian diet. Because at that time, they had the capacity physically to live 800 or 900 years. And if you're going to live that long, it's important that you avoid certain foodstuffs that would load your body up with heavy metals. So that explains why God said, you know, avoid meat. But once the flood was over, God said, your lifespan is going to be a maximum of about 120 years. You can eat all the meat you want, it isn't going to make any difference. And therefore, they were allowed to expand their diet at that time. And this idea that there was no death until Adam and Eve offended God by sinning in the Garden of Eden is explained in Romans chapter 5, verse 12, where it makes the point that when Adam rebelled against God, death through sin was visited upon all men. And by the way, this is repeated in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 20 to 22. But notice that Paul's making two careful qualifications. He says, death through sin. Well, that implies we're talking about the death of spiritual beings, not non-spiritual beings. And he says, death through sin was visited upon all men. He didn't say all life. He said all men. And so this is something that's specific to the human species. And so Adam and Eve evidently had the potential to live forever in a physical state here on planet Earth. They had access to the Tree of Life, after all. But once they rebelled against God, God sent two angels to block access to the tree of life. Why? Lest they live forever in a physical state, but would be eternally dead in a spiritual state. And what Paul is explaining in Romans chapter 5 is how God in the Garden of Eden blessed Adam and Eve and all their descendants with the gift of physical death so that they could be delivered from the far worse consequence of spiritual death. That's kind of what's interesting. When I first picked up this Bible at age 17, that's kind of the paradox I was facing. All throughout the Bible it says the pathway to life is through death. You have to die in order to live. But that's because we're spiritual beings with the potential to live in a spiritual state forever. And we can live forever spiritually dead, or we can live forever spiritually alive. But thanks to the tool of physical death, both of human beings and of the creator of the universe, Jesus Christ, we can be delivered from that spiritual death. So, in no way does it say that there were no death of plants and animals before Adam sinned. In fact, the Bible is very clear. The laws of physics do not change between the creation of the universe and the end of all evil. And with no change in the laws of physics, there would have to be death. And likewise, you would need carnivorous activity in order to ensure that the herbivores live as long and healthy a life as possible. So I think the problem is that we humans look at the text and think death is bad in all contexts. No, death is a special gift. Okay, go ahead.
I have a few questions and one valid one. So the most important question I would ask is, there are many scientists or Christians that believe in older, old universe and young universe. And I just see there's a huge conflict between these two groups who are both Christians, they both love Jesus Christ, they both are followers of the true God. And I'd like to explain something on your website. There's one section there, paragraph says, avoiding a dangerous trap. And you go into the subject of young universe believers, and you equate them with, on the same lines as you do Mary Eddie Baker, a Christian scientist. And I will quote directly from your website. I'm excited to explain this more. On the assumption that they truly desire to be defenders of the truth of God's word and evangelists for Jesus Christ, young universe creationists probably do not realize the theological implications. Of their position. I think they would repudiate the cultic notion that there is no life, truth, or substance in matter, which is a quotation from Christian Science.
Right.
So unfortunately, that's the direction in their, which their view leads. According to Paul, it's a dangerous direction to Colossians 1 and 2 specifically. I would like to know how being a young universe, young Earth creation, is equivalent to being on the same lines of.
Well, from what you've read, I was very careful to say that they're not purposely espousing a Gnostic theology. They're unwittingly positing a Gnostic theology. And as I've talked to me, a number of younger creationist leaders have discussed this very issue with me. And they appreciated the fact that I was not accusing them directly of being Gnostics. I mean, just like me, they would hate the Gnostic heresy. But if it's really true that the universe we're looking at is not real, then you really are falling into a Gnostic trap. And that's the problem. They don't realize that their theological interpretation of the universe puts them in that position.
Can you explain unreal universe?
Well, in the sense that when we look at the universe, we're looking back in time. And because it takes like time to travel from these objects to our telescope. So, I remind my friends that because I'm an astronomer, I'm completely ignorant of the present. I only know about the past. Because, you know, even when we look at the sun, we're looking at the sun as it was 8 minutes ago, not as it is now. But we have these look-back times that take us back over 13 billion years. And so you would have to argue that either there's something wrong with the constants of physics, that they were millions of times faster in the past than they are today, or that the universe we're looking at is a mirage. And the universe is a mirage, and you're kind of into the Gnostic trap of saying the physical world is not trustworthy, it's not really there, and all we can trust is the spiritual data that we have through written communication, which is basically what the Gnostics were saying when the Apostle Paul was writing Colossians and Galatians. And he was making the point that God has given us two books, the book of nature and the book of scripture, and both are utterly trustworthy and reliable. And therefore, what we see coming through the book of nature can't contradict what we see in the book of the scripture. And, you know, this is where I have a problem with a lot of my young earth creationist friends, is that, you know, they're biblicists. They believe that the Bible is the only reliable revelation. They really have no confidence in the book of nature, but it was the Apostle Paul that told us that the real physical world is a trustworthy revelation from God that we're to read. You know, Psalm 19, which Paul quoted, tells us that God speaks through the universe as well as through the books that make up the Bible. And therefore, we need to be very careful about adopting an interpretation of the universe or life's history, which puts us in a position of saying it's all a mirage, or it looks old, but in fact, it really is very young. No, God faithfully reveals himself without error in both of his books. It's kind of like arguing that maybe Hebrews contradicts Romans. No, they're both inspired by the same God who's responsible for both. It's a God for whom it's impossible to lie. And likewise, we carry that into science. If we see something in biology that appears to contradict what we're measuring in physics, we know we've made an error in interpretation. And so we go back onto our data and our interpretations and say, where did we go wrong? We don't draw the conclusion that, say, the light we see on planet Earth is an illusion, or the stars are an illusion. No, we question our interpretation. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't believe young Earth creationists are saying that light is an illusion, or that the universe is an illusion. It would be an illusion to assume that Adam was 30 years old as an infirm man who created it and went out. So my speculation more is towards what you stated on your website, is that even mentioning that young Earth creationists are in line or heading towards the same illusion as creation scientists by Marianne Baker, I believe is very inappropriate, and that needs to be addressed.
Well, I think I tried to do that by saying, you know, because they don't realize what's going on in astronomy, they have unwittingly fallen into this. I was very careful not to say that they were purposely trying to take a Mary Baker Eddy theology. Mary Baker Eddy was doing it on purpose. I think young Earth creationists don't realize that they're falling into that Gnostic trap. And, you know, you can read their literature. They'll either say that it's appearance of age, or they'll say that the laws of physics were a million times faster in the past. The problem, that's basically where they are today. They're on record as saying that the laws of physics were a million times faster in the past than they are today. But the problem there is we astronomers can measure the constants of physics at various distances that we observe. And they show that the laws of physics have not changed. Moreover, there's Bible verses like Jeremiah 33:25 that tell us that the laws of physics are fixed. They're constant. The laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed, Jeremiah 33:25. And if that's the case, then the young earth position really is forced to say it's all an illusion. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Jewish and I'm an agnostic. So, but the question I have for you is, I think you had mentioned at one time that or at least the Christians believe that when you die, if you're a good person, that Jesus will escort you through the threshold and you eventually get a new body. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Well, now the Muslims...
No, wait a minute. There's one more point where I won't agree with. It's not based on how good you are. It's based on whether you're prepared to submit to the authority of Jesus Christ for the rest of your life, and are you willing to transfer your moral imperfection for his moral perfection. It's got nothing to do with how good of a life you live. It has everything to do with what you decide to respond to God's offer to trade his moral perfection for moral perfection, and also to recognize that he knows better than we do what's best to run our life. You can put it this way. You're going to live forever whether you want to or not. Every spiritual being lives forever, but you do get to choose where you will spend eternity. And heaven is a place for people who want to submit to the authority of God. But God's not going to force you to submit to his authority. He says, if you want this, then you're welcome. So that's the condition.
Well, now, what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, Muslims believe that if you're submit to the will of Allah, Muhammad, and whatever, then you can have sex with 86 virgins. Is that true? That the Muslims actually believe that?
Yes, I don't think it's as high as 86.
I was wondering, if it's 71 virgins, if the Muslims believe that, then it would appear to me that both are true. Because after having sex with 71 virgins, you would need a new body. I just want to ask you that the DNA that we have, if God made us in his own image, would that mean that God would have similar DNA that we have? Or does he have DNA?
Well, the Christian perspective is that God is one. One essence and three persons. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The Father and the Holy Spirit do not have physical bodies. They are spiritual. Only the Son has the fullness of the deity in bodily form. And so when he spent his time here on earth, he humbled himself and lowered himself and took human form, which means he had DNA. So only in that context could we say that, God must have DNA like we have DNA. That would be true only of the incarnate of Christ. And what our new bodies will be like, I don't know, but it does tell us in Corinthians that when we do receive our new bodies, those of us who choose to submit to the authority of the Creator of the universe for the rest of eternity, it will be a body that will not be corruptible. And the thing we notice about DNA is it constantly has to be repaired. So evidently, we're going to have some kind of physical structure, probably subject to different laws of physics and different space-time dimensions that will not subject any kind of decay at all. So it will be different than the DNA. So it's going to be a radically different kind of body. And it'll be a body that will not have your chin sag under the influence of gravity. Electromagnetism won't break it down. But I believe in a new creation. There will be no thermodynamics, there will be no electromagnetism, no gravity, and will completely different dimensions of length, width, height, and time. But yeah, your body will be different from this body, and it will never decay, it will never corrupt. And you won't get that. So. Go ahead.
Dr. Ross, we had the privilege of working together about a year ago to visit your presentation to Global Living Emergencies, and I thank you for that. I want to switch gears a little bit. I didn't see any restrictions on the kind of questions that you would be willing to deal with. I'd like to talk about a New Testament problem. And you have referred to Paul authoritatively many times, including in reference to the book of Galatians. And I have been puzzled over the potential and perhaps actual disconnect between the Pauline notion of what Jesus was or is and the gospel of Acts. portrayal of Jesus, and I'd like you to consider this problem. In Galatians 1 and 2, Paul makes it clear that the gospel he has been preaching to them has been learned from no man, and has been learned completely by revelation by God, when Jesus appeared to him. And he also makes it clear that subsequent to that revelation, he did not learn subsequently anything from the apostles of Jerusalem either, because he goes on to describe that they just took out from Jerusalem, and they approved what he was teaching, but he did not learn something from them that he did not already know from Revelation. And yet, it seems to me that the traditional view of what Paul taught assumes that Paul was lying in verse 1 and 2, because in 1 Corinthians, for example, when he talks about Jesus there, he makes reference to things like, I pass on to you what I have received. And as far as I know, traditional Christianity, including perhaps, assumed that Paul is referring to that which he learned from the apostles and the relatives of Jesus, where I presided in Galatians. So this gives rise to the question of, there being a different kind of Jesus that Paul is talking about versus what the Gospels and Acts is talking about. I'd like you to see if you can solve that problem a little bit.
Okay, that's a problem that was raised a couple hundred years ago. Is there a difference in the gospel message from Paul as you get from, say, the disciples that lived with Jesus during his ministry here on earth? And the passages you're quoting don't really specify exactly which individuals Paul was referring to when he said that he was getting this information. What we do know about the Apostle Paul is that he was a member of the Sanhedrin. He was the youngest member of the Sanhedrin, very well educated and very intelligent. So he was well versed in the Jewish scriptures. And when Jesus revealed himself to him on the road to Damascus, that revelation helped him to connect all those Old Testament passages that he studied with the fact that Jesus was a fulfillment of all those Old Testament passages. And as you mentioned, he was excited. He was sharing his faith all over the region of Damascus, and it went down to Jerusalem. And the apostles there were very excited about the ministry of the Apostle Paul. They basically said, if you stay here, you'll get killed. And so they purposely sent him on his way. So his contact, as he points out, with the apostles was very brief. Basically, it was one of saying, look, we're excited about what happened to you, but you better hit the road, because there are Judaizers here which will kill you if you stay. So what did he do? He went to Tarsus. And Paul tells us later, he studied diligently for 14 years in Tarsus. And with Barnabas, that went to Tarsus and recruited him for the mission of taking the gospel to the Gentiles. Because now it was at a point in the history where it was a little safer, still not safe, but a little bit safer to minister to the Gentiles than it was 14 years earlier. And the reason why Barnabas went to Tarsus to get Paul, he says, this fellow is really very learned. And he's learned not only in the ways of the Jews, he's learned in the ways of the Gentiles. Barnabas correctly discerned that he could have a huge impact on going throughout Asia Minor and Greece and Italy and preaching the gospel. So I think that helps us figure where he got his education from. He got a lot of his education before Jesus began his ministry, some during and some after. But I think he was truthful in saying the bulk of my education about the gospel did not come as a result of extended study with the apostles. My time with them was very brief. And also I think part of the context is this, is that people were perceiving a conflict between Peter and Paul. This is all, again, part of this idea that in order for Gentiles to be part of the church, they had to be circumcised. And so Paul was making his point that circumcision was not necessary for salvation. And, you know, he was making the point that he got this from his own independent study, and it wasn't just something he was borrowing from others. So I think that's the point he was really making. He says, I'm drawing these conclusions not because I've been influenced by others, but just because I've given this very thorough study. So, oh, by the way, let me make a brief comment about DNA, because it came up twice, and both times I got diverted by other questions. And this is something my colleague Franz Ronach has written extensively about in his blogs on our website at reasons.org. And also, I want to commend his latest book. We're releasing it for the first time today. It just got published. It's called Creating Light in the Lab. And he deals with the DNA questions that have been raised here, making a point that from a Christian perspective, you would anticipate more similarity in the DNA of different species of life than you would from a Darwinian perspective. A Darwinian perspective would predict a fair amount of diversity, but the truth is, when you look at the DNA of the different plants and animals, we see far more similarity than we would anticipate from a Darwinian perspective. And that's a creator that's using optimized designs. And keep in mind, 35% of our DNA is identical to daffodils. And what works well for daffodils also works well for us. So it's best for the daffodil, in many cases, it's best for us. And so, of course, God is going to use those DNA templates over and over again. And we actually see a biblical reference to that in Genesis chapter 2, where it says, God put Adam to sleep, took a biopsy from his side, and used the DNA in that biopsy as a template to make certain engineering adjustments to make the woman. So that would indicate that you know, God does use repeated designs. Anyway, there's a lot in Fuzz's book about these repeated designs. There's even more in his book called The Cell of Design. Both books we have here, and they're written by someone who's an expert in the DNA. I don't claim to be an expert in DNA. Okay, next question.
Yeah, it's the same area that I've got. I wanted to ask you, what is God's intent and purpose in creating different races and geographic regions in terms of the birth of Christ? If you could please explain. Thank you.
Well, that's a debated question. Where did the races come from, and what purpose would different races have from God's perspective? And I've argued in my book, The Genesis Question, that you can't explain the racial distinctives of the human species if you're appealing to Darwinian evolutionary mechanisms. There isn't enough environmental pressure to produce both the distinctives and the separation of the distinctives into different geographical areas. I mean, the common argument is that white skin has an advantage when you're near the poles, and dark skin has an advantage when you're near the equator. And that explains everything, except for the fact that the Eskimos have dark skin and not light skin. And so what we really see in the Bible is that God set up these different races and put them in different geographical locations. It doesn't really tell us why. But I speculate in my book, The Genesis Question, that perhaps it served a purpose in maintaining antitrust legislation. In this sense, that it tells us in the text he gave us different languages, and he set up the world in such a way that nations would have defensible borders. And so as I look at the map of the world, it is amazing that you've got mountain ranges and rivers and deserts and straits. And the oceans in ideal locations to facilitate the multiplication of these different nations, some big and strong, some small and weak, but the small and weak are able to survive because of the geographical barrier borders that they can set up, but also because they've got different languages. You're going to think twice about leaving your country and learning a different language. But if everybody spoke the same language, it would be easy for a powerful nation to oppress a weaker nation. And likewise, perhaps racial diversity played a role in that. Now, what is interesting, as you see in the book of Revelation, is it speaks about a time when the peoples of the world will once again be like they were in the days before the flood, all in one big nation, ruled by one government, and also predicts that when that is set up, there will be serious oppression of the peoples of the world for a very brief time, basically to teach the peoples of the world a very an important lesson. But it also tells us that at that time, geography will no longer be a barrier. Language will no longer be a barrier, and racial distinctives will no longer be a barrier. And those of us living here in the Los Angeles area, I think, are already seeing that. Racial distinctives are no longer a barrier. Languages aren't the barrier they were. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be going to China to speak. And they told me that this time I don't have to have Mandarin PowerPoints. They said, just use English. Everybody here understands English, at least the audiences you'll be addressing. And literally, every week, a language disappears. And then again, because of air travel and modern technology, the geographical barriers that were once important for keeping nations separate no longer are barriers. So we may be moving into that time. I've also written some articles on our website about DNA studies that are showing us where the racial distinctives may have come from, that it was a supernatural intervention at the time of the close of the end or the extinction of the Neanderthals that may have had a role in bringing about the racial distinctives that we see. So, time will tell. I mean, research is ongoing on this. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Raj. It's so good to hear your questions. I was just wondering if there are other dimensions that are beyond our senses. How are we able to know that they exist, since they're beyond our perception? And how many dimensions there are?
Okay, good question. There's a book there called Beyond the Cosmos, which will go into a lot more detail, and I'll take time to do right now. But we know that there must be at least six other dimensions of space. You need that many dimensions in order to have quantum mechanics and a gravity coexist. And it's also necessary to explain the function of fundamental particles. And so every physicist today believes that in addition to length, width, and height, there are six extremely small dimensions of space that accompany the three big ones. And from an astronomer's perspective, the universe begins with nine dimensions of space that rapidly expand from the cosmic creation event. At 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the cosmic creation event, six of those dimensions stop expanding, and only three continue to expand thereafter. They still exist today, but they're no bigger than they were at 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the cosmic creation event. It was the separation of the force of gravity from the other three forces of physics that played a role in stopping the expansion of those three dimensions of space. Now, we also know there must be something beyond time, because the space-time theorems tell us that at the beginning of the universe is the beginning of space and time itself. So, before the universe, there would be no length, width, height, time, or the other six dimensions. It also tells us there must be a causal agent beyond space and time that's responsible for bringing this universe into existence. Now, the one definition of time that all scientists would agree on is that dimension or realm in which cause and effect phenomena take place, where effects always follow after the causes, which implies that whatever or whoever created the universe must have access at a minimum to the equivalent of two independent dimensions of time. And therefore, for the one that created the universe, there must be dimensional reality beyond our 10 space-time dimensions. Now, what you'll see in the Bible is that the angels live in a dimensional reality completely different from ours. And likewise, heaven and hell are different dimensional realities. And God is a being who can create dimensional realities at will and remove them at will. There's also three places in the Bible that tells us a time will come in the future when God will remove the dimensions of this physical universe. In an instant, they'll be gone. There's actually models in Big Bang cosmology that predict that that will happen. So, you say, when is that going to happen? Well, it could be tomorrow, but also could be several billion years off in the future. The Creator will be controlling that moment, as it tells us in Revelation. It will happen when evil is conquered and removed. Then the universe will disappear from existence and be replaced by a completely different dimensional realm. The dimensions of this universe, I argue, and why the universe is the way it is, are in place because they're the best possible dimensions to bring about the end of all evil and suffering as quickly and as painlessly as possible for the human species. That's the main purpose of the universe that God creates, to be a vehicle where through the human species, God can rid this creation of evil and suffering once and for all. And when that happens, our space-time dimensions no longer have any purpose. God will remove them from existence and replace them with dimensions that are going to allow the rewards of the new creation. You can read all about it in the last two chapters of the Bible.
Yeah, earlier there were questions about the manifestation events and the re-speaking manifestation events. And as was discussed, there's hard data for the speed of those processes. And there's much hard data for the severity of the extinction event, that no large body animals go forward from one epoch into the other. Because it seems like for transitional forms to rise in the lifetimes of generations of large body animals, 100,000 years is really quite fast.
Yes.
For large body species to come up, and we have to start from very small, simple animals to come in, both predators and herbivores. And if the processes were that rapid during confined spaces around those extinction events, then why would the physical laws prevent those processes from continuing in such a rapid way? Because it seems like this fossil record shows that the species that you see arise are then constant through the geological layers without a lot of change in transitional forms. In fact, no transitional forms in between extinction events.
Well, all the extinction events that we measure do not wipe out all species of life. There's always survivors. But for example, the Permian extinction event wiped out 90-95% of all marine life and 90-95% of all land life, and it looks like anything bigger than a centimeter was wiped out. And so that's the challenge for the evolutionists, is if you wipe out everything bigger than a centimeter, how do you explain things as big as dinosaurs or birds and mammals showing up in just less than 100,000 years with optimized ecological relationships? I mean, no evolutionary model can explain that. Now, the response is what you suggest. They're arguing that these mass extinction events are tepid events, not catastrophic events. And so for the past 20 years, there's been a debate in the scientific literature over just how catastrophic or how immediate. There's two lines of approach. They will say that the catastrophe was much more benign than what certain physicists claim, or it was a bunch of smaller events over a longer period of time. The debate appears to resolve around, are we looking at extraterrestrial collision events, asteroids and comets hitting the Earth, or are we looking at volcanic eruptions? And what we see in the data for the bigger mass extinction events, you see evidence for volcanic damage. You also see evidence for collision damage. While it's being resolved in this sense, if the Earth gets hit with a big enough asteroid, it's going to puncture a hole through the crust of the Earth, and it's going to ignite volcanic eruptions all over the Earth. And so it explains both sets of data, why we have data for a collision event and why we have data for these massive volcanic eruptions. For example, the Permian catastrophe shows enough volcanic eruption that it would create lava 20 feet deep, covering the entire surface of the Earth, including the oceans. So we're really talking massive volcanic eruptions. But the evidence is now telling us that that was stimulated by an asteroid probably 10 kilometers to 10 miles in diameter hitting the Earth. And if such an asteroid hits the Earth, anything bigger than a centimeter simply will not be able to breathe, because you get a dust cloud pumped up into the atmosphere, which basically chokes out anything that's consuming any significant amount of oxygen. So to explain why you get this instant removal of all the dinosaurs, birds and mammals, reptiles, amphibians, fish get wiped out, because these are all creatures that need significant amounts of oxygen, and the event simply chokes all that out for a period of time. But of course, things eventually recover. And when they recover, you get a mass speciation event. Now, the fossil record seems to be showing that the recovery time varies. But that, I think, is understandable, because certain events will be so severe that you're going to need a significant period of time before the dust settles, so to speak, where you could have these creatures being able to survive on the face of the Earth. Clearly, the Creator is going to wait till the hostile conditions become benign enough where you can step in and create these creatures, and they'll be able to continue to survive. This is still a very fervent area of research. And you know, we've been trying to keep up with it, and you'll see a number of our Today's New Reasons to Believe articles that deal with this debate over the mass extinction and the mass speciation events. But there's been a significant advance in the last year that it's not volcanoes or collisions, it's a collision that stimulates a volcanic disaster. And actually makes, it actually explains why things are as catastrophic as they are. By the way, a 10-mile diameter asteroid hitting the Earth will burn all the vegetation on the face of the Earth right away. So you just get huge grass and forest fires over the entire planet. You get piles of dust thrown in the atmosphere, and literally creatures like us die within minutes from asphyxiation. Plus, you get a lot of heat being and creatures that are within a few thousand miles, they die first from the blast, because you get this huge blast wave that just kills everything in its path. But even if you're 10,000 miles away, the dust eventually will get you.
If you could elaborate a little further, please, on one gentleman's earlier statement about DNA in an argument against divine creation. Of course, we would contend that DNA, being a highly structured set of information, would be an argument for creation. As I often like to point out, that if you take one of the simplest amino acids that you can get, you go from the chain up to 1,000 more. You take one that's only about 120 chain of amino acids from a protein, so it's a very simple one. Even if you assume every single atom in the universe having 1 trillion chemical interactions per second, it would take a universe that's 100 billion times 30 billion years, as Pete's boy, to just get that first simple amino acid. And DNA is horrendously more complex than that, with information that Bill Gates says it's a giant software program. So I'd like to know if you could elaborate on the software and information never provides questions.
Well, that gives me an excuse to talk about this paper that I picked up just a few days ago. And it's making the point that research is showing us that there were two amino acids, lysine and arginine. Now, most of you probably heard of lysine as being widely recommended as something you should take on a daily basis to prevent cardiovascular disease. But if you eat lots of rice, you'll also get plenty of lysine. There are lots of foods with lysine in it. But arginine is also vital. But arginine and lysine are what are called basic amino acids, which means that, well, again, you've got four kinds. You've got the polar, the nonpolar, the acidic, and the basic. These two are basic. But we now know that from simulation experiments for making amino acids, similar to the Burdi-Miller experiment, are unable to produce this arginine and lysine. They can produce the rest, but they can't produce these two. No experiment's been able to produce those two. Moreover, we don't find those two amino acids in any meteorite. When we look at meteorites, the carbonaceous meteorites, we find amino acids. By the way, we find them at extremely low abundance levels, far too low to be of any value to any origin of life scenario. But what is interesting, as pointed out in this paper, is there's no lysine, there's no arginine. Those are missing. And so the question this article draws up from an atheistic perspective, is it possible to have some kind of origin of life scenario where you've got no lysine and no arginine, and they show up later? And what they show is, yeah, you can make a number of proteins. They successfully were able to build in a lab 61 very simple protein-like structures. But they also commented that under normal laboratory conditions, it'd be very unlikely to get beyond those 61. And none of those 61 play any role in interactions between proteins and nucleic acids. And so they basically said this is a huge problem for a naturalistic origin of life scenario, namely that if you don't have arginine and you don't have lysine, there's no way you're going to be able to set up a system where proteins can communicate with the DNA and the DNA communicate with proteins. And if you don't have that, you don't have an origin of life scenario. So I'm just saying you don't have to even get into the information complexity that the questioner just brought to the microphone. Even something as simple as this lays out that you don't have the building blocks that you need. And for what it's worth, we have yet to find an amino acid in an interstellar cloud. We've yet to find a nucleotide or a nucleoside in an interstellar cloud. We've yet to find a 5-carbon sugar in an interstellar cloud. And we know none of those things existed on the primordial Earth. By the way, I do believe as an astronomer, we'll one day find nucleotides and amino acids in these interstellar clouds, which is really the best astrophysical site for finding them. But we're going to be finding them at parts per billion. We've not been able to find them at parts per million, but I do think we'll find them at parts per billion. But I also agree with this article, we're not going to find lysine, we're not going to find arginine, we'll find things like lysine at parts per billion. But if there are parts per billion, as they commented here, this is of no help to an origin of life scenario. You need them at much more greater concentrations than parts per thousand. And so even parts per million wouldn't help any kind of origin of life scenario. But yeah, the two claims in the literature that they found lysine interstellar cloud, and they found one of the nucleotides in an interstellar cloud, both claims have been withdrawn. They misidentified the spectral lines. But again, I think if we do careful enough work, we will find them, but at extremely low abundance levels. Go ahead.
You have two questions.
But by the way, before you have your question, I know a lot of you have been waiting for us to give away a bunch of stuff here. Why don't we do the giveaway, then I'll take your question. And given that it's close to one, we'll make this the last question. So, and I've got a couple more cards. All right. I'll let you pose the question. We'll collect the last two cards, and I'll answer it after the giveaway.
All right. I've got two. The first one I'm going to answer just quickly. Is there a verse regarding God, whether he would trick or not, regarding especially over the young earth?
It's quite the opposite, Ross, is that there are 11 passages in the Bible that tell us that God would never trick us or deceive us. There are 8 places where it tells us it's impossible for God to lie. When people say God can do anything he wants, well, there are some things he doesn't want to do. One thing he never wants to do is to lie or deceive. And that would include that Adam. The comment was made that since Adam was 5 or 6 feet tall, he had the appearance of age. He would only have the appearance of age if he was from the womb of a woman. But the text is very clear. He did not come from the womb of a woman. When God made him, he made him full size. So I would argue Adam was brand new when God created him. He didn't have 30 years worth of aging on his body. So I would argue if the scientists were there to check him out, there'd be no scar tissue. He wouldn't be bald. He wouldn't have gray hair like you and I have. He would be brand new. And he wouldn't have glasses either. So, all right. Okay, let me pick a card out here. And this is going to be for why the universe is the way it is. And it's Timothy Fuente. Okay. All right, I may have got the pronunciation wrong. Okay, next we're going to give away this thing called the Great Debate. I didn't put that title on it. The Skeptic Society did. This is a debate I had with Victor Singer at Caltech in front of an audience of 700 atheists. And that's going to go to Lori Hoppen-Gian. All right. Okay. And last, this is The Fingerprint of God. It's the first book I ever published. And this is a commemorative edition, which means we put a whole bunch of photos in there. That's your copy? Oh, sorry. I guess I'm going to give that away. Tell you what. I'll give away this one. Creating Life in the Lab. This is Fuzz's latest book, literally being released today. And, now you've got nothing to worry about. I picked your card. So I can give you the fingerprint of God. You want this one? All right. See, God really was in control, right? All right, I'll take the second half of your question.
What is your position on global warming?
What is my position on global warming?
We have another hour.
It could easily take an hour, but let me just wrap this up quickly. I do have a book coming out probably early fall, late summer, that actually addresses the global warming question. In fact, makes the claim that the best prescription for resolving global warming, which is, by the way, revealing my position, I believe global warming is real. I think the data is unquestioned that the planet is getting warmer. The debate, though, is why is it getting warmer? And some will argue that it's getting warmer because of natural cycles of the Earth orbiting the Sun in the manner that it does, or that human activity through our industrialization is responsible for global warming. I think the truth is that both contribute to some degree. As an astronomer, I can tell you that when the Earth orbits the Sun, the shape of its orbit varies over a 100,000-year cycle. And it becomes more eccentric and less eccentric, and that affects the climate. And we can see that in ice core drills, that the planet gets warmer and cooler in response to the orbit of the Earth above the Sun. And by the way, we also see a change in the inclination of the Earth's orbit, and that has a climatic effect as well. And it's typically such that you get 90,000 years of an ice age followed by 10,000 years of a warm period. And in many respects, human activity has been responsible for extending the warm period from 10,000 years to 15,000 years. We've now had an interglacial lasting for 15,000 years. You say, what kicked it off? Well, what really helped was our domestication of cows. And by the way, when global warming advocates like Al Gore, for example, will argue that we have to stop driving automobiles and we have to stop pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from our factories, the UN, in studying global warming in terms of human activity, ranks that as number three. Number one, in terms of human activity contributing to global warming, is our dependence on beef as a food supply. Cows are extremely proficient in releasing greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. Anyone who's a farmer would be well aware of that. And we've actually bred the cows to be more efficient in releasing greenhouse gases. They're about five times as efficient in releasing greenhouse gases as they were before we domesticated them, which is why we're able to get so much milk from them and meat and other products. And then the number two contributor to global warming is all the forests we've cut down to make pasture land for our cows. So, and then number three would be our industrial activity. So as the UN has pointed out, we'd be much wiser to focus on the cow problem than we would the factory problem or the automobile problem in resolving global warming. And I won't give you the answer, but the book of Job, you can read it, chapter 38 and 39, tells us why God gave us the cow. It wasn't for meat. And why there are other animals that we could use that would be the biggest thing we could do to resolve global warming. But really the message of the book of Job is this. Whenever we human beings face a crisis because of our mismanagement of the planet, God in advance has already provided a solution that is optimally ethical and optimally economic. And if you read the book of Job, you'll see a solution to global warming that would not only restore the atmosphere of the planet to a condition that would obviate much of our global warming, not all of it, but would obviate some of it, and at the same time would make us very wealthy. So whenever someone tells you you have to sacrifice economics in order to do the right thing, they haven't got the right solution. And the other thing goes as well, too. Someone that tells you that you have to sacrifice ethics in order to get the best economical solution, you know you've got the wrong solution. God has designed the universe, the planet, and all of its life in such a way that we humans will always be able to find a solution where we get the best economics combined with the best ethics. And you could extend that to all kinds of issues in addition to global warming, for example, like stem cell research. And so the problem is we tend to be too quick to find solutions. We need to dig and find the right solution. But Job anticipated it 4,000 years ago. So or you can read about it by looking at those chapters. You need some help. Wait for the book in a few months' time. I think it's a good place to close. So I want to thank all of you for coming, and we'll be doing this again in August. Typically, we do it every quarter.
Tomorrow night
we have one. Yes, yeah, so young man enough, you can come tomorrow night, 154 building, which is just a few feet away from here. We'll be doing this again at 7 o'clock. And just like today, we're going to have fabulous treats for all of you to consume. So there's more than one reason to come to these things. Thank you.
Thank you.